Welcome to episode 4 of the Mail Mysteries podcast. It's been quite a while since our last show. When I got back from my holiday break, I hit the ground running, and life has been hectic ever since. Keeping me away from this podcast were several projects related to work. There was a science fiction conference that I attended, a horrendous Mercury retrograde that seemed entirely focused on my car, which has been in and out of the shop the better part of the last month and a half, and a full moon lunar eclipse in my own sign of Virgo. Also, this episode covers a lot of material. There's so much material, I've decided to spread it across 2 consecutive episodes. This episode will focus mainly on ageism and aging, and the next will focus on mentoring and gay rites of passage. This month, I'll be finishing up the homoerotic triad of Eros, Hermes, and Heracles. Because Heracles is associated with pederastic relationships, it got me thinking about all sorts of issues related to age differences and interactions between age groups within the gay community. In this episode, I'll be talking about age differences in gay relationships, attitudes between older and younger gay men, and some of my own experiences with age and aging. I'll also be talking about a pretty controversial topic, pederasty, the relationship between an adult male and an adolescent male. Given Heracles' own pederastic relationships, this seems an appropriate subject for this show.
Gay Gods.
The last in the homoerotic trinity of Eros, Hermes, and Heracles is Heracles. I covered Eros and Hermes in 2 previous podcasts. Heracles isn't a god per se, but a divine hero. In Greek mythology, some heroes are granted divinity for their good works in life. Heracles is one of the greatest Greek heroes who was a champion of the Olympian order. Heracles was the paragon of strength and masculinity. Among the Romans and in the Western world, he is known as Hercules. Among the characteristics of Heracles are extraordinary strength, courage, ingenuity, and sexual prowess with both males and females. In spite of his strength, he sometimes used his wits to win a battle. Along with Hermes, Heracles is the patron and protector of the gymnasia and the palaestrae, the ancient Greek wrestling schools. Heracles was said to be a benefactor, making the world safe for mankind. He was said to be extremely passionate, doing great deeds for his friends and enacting terrible vengeance on those who crossed him. He was also said to be very playful, and he used games to relax from his labors. Many stories were told about his life, the most famous being the 12 labors of Heracles. Heracles was considered both a hero and a god. At festivals, sacrifice was made to him, first as a hero in the form of a libation, and then as a god upon an altar. The ancient Greeks celebrated the festival of Heraclea, which honored the death of Heracles on the second day of the month of Metageitnion, which would fall somewhere around the end of July or the beginning of August. Heracles was conceived as the result of an affair Zeus had with the mortal woman Alcmene. And I hope I'm pronouncing these right. Zeus disguised himself as her husband and had his way with her. Later that night, the husband did come home, and Alcmene became pregnant with twins by the 2 different fathers. As Heracles' birth was proof of at least 1 illicit affair by her husband, Zeus, the goddess Hera held great animosity toward Heracles. While given the name Alcides at birth, he was later renamed Heracles, meaning the glory of Hera, or glorious through Hera, in an unsuccessful attempt to appease her. Just a few months after his birth, Hera sent 2 serpents to kill him in his crib, but Heracles strangled a snake in each hand and was found by his nurse playing with them. In his youth, he was visited by 2 nymphs, Pleasure and Virtue, who offered him a choice between a pleasant and easy life or a severe but glorious life. He chose the latter. Heracles had a number of sexual liaisons with both women and boys. During his life, he married 4 times. As a symbol of his masculinity and warriorship, Heracles had a number of pederastic male beloveds. Plutarch, in his Eroticos, states that the Eraminoi, male lovers of Heracles, were too many to count. Among Heracles' male lovers was Prince Hylas of the Dryopians. Hylas was offered to Heracles after Heracles killed their king. The youth became his weapons-bearer and his beloved. Several years later, Hylas was kidnapped by a nymph never to be seen again. Heracles was heartbroken and spent a long time searching for him. Another of his young male lovers was the Theban Iolaus, Aeolus was Heracles' charioteer and squire. As a testament to the closeness between the two heroes, Aeolus shares Heracles' altar. Unlike other heroes and gods who had their own altars, sacrifices to either Heracles or Aeolus could be made at the same altar. Aeolus was a patron of male love. Plutarch reports that male couples would go to Aeolus's tomb in Thebes to swear an oath of loyalty to the hero and to each other. Many of Heracles' pederastic relationships illustrate the elements of Greek pederasty as an apprenticeship and initiatory experience where the older warrior educates the younger and concludes with the eventual promotion of the younger to adult status and marriage to a woman. Upon Heracles' death, he was raised to the status of godhood. As his body was burned on the funeral pyre, only his immortal side is left, and his father Zeus raised him up to Olympus as he died.
This is the story of a time long ago, a time of myth and legend, when the ancient gods were petty and cruel, and they plagued mankind with suffering. Only one man dared to challenge their power, Hercules. Hercules possessed a strength the world had never seen, a strength surpassed only by the power of his heart. He journeyed the earth, battling the minions of his wicked stepmother Hera, the all-powerful queen of the gods. But wherever there was evil, wherever an innocent would suffer, there would be Hercules.
How deeply does ageism cut into the gay community among gay men, and how does it affect both the older and younger generations of gay men? American culture as a whole is youth-oriented, but among gay men it's even more explicit. In a study of over 2,000 gay men, a researcher and journalist named Tim Bergling did a study to learn more about gay male attitudes toward aging. He also wrote a book based on his findings called Reeling in the Years, Gay Men's Perspectives on Age and Ageism. I actually found his book available in my local library, and it's really quite fascinating. It's put a lot of things into perspective for me. Before reading his book, I expected ageism in the gay community to be largely skewed against older gay men, which often means those over the age of 40, but sometimes this can mean someone over the age of 30, or it can even mean someone over the age of 25, depending on who you talk to. I was surprised to learn that this ageism works both ways and often plays out as an us versus them attitude. Both older and younger men as a whole tend to view the other group with a wary trepidation at best and outright hostility at worst. Sometimes members of one group have been hurt in some way by someone in the other group, but just as often, perhaps more often, their attitudes are based on rumors, myths, or even society's homophobic attitudes as a whole. It's also kind of funny, a sad kind of irony, that both groups tend to think of the other as oversexed, slutty, and shallow. According to Bergling's research, no one is allowed so much as to flirt or express interest without being labeled a slut. Many younger folks believe that older gay men are, quote, trolls, chicken hawks, or bitter old queens. Younger gay men often believe the myth that older men are chicken hawks out to prey on them and take advantage of them. This attitude closely mirrors the homophobic attitude among some close-minded heterosexuals that gay men are pedophiles or out to seduce or convert young men to the, quote, homosexual lifestyle. Older gay men often think that the younger gay guys are shallow, only interested in partying, perfect bods, and possibly even doing drugs. It's ironic that we take the homophobia directed against us by society and turn it against ourselves. I mean, so long as sex is consensual and safe, what's the big deal about who does who or how often? It's all a matter of personal preference anyway. One of the reasons negative myths and attitudes about gay aging persist is the lack of social contact between older and younger gay men. Often gay men entering middle age move on from the things they did when they were young, like going to bars and clubs. Another thing that has led to a gap between the generations was the AIDS epidemic that literally wiped out an entire generation of gay men who would have bridged the gap through their own experiences of aging and by being friends, lovers, and role models, a go-between between the older and younger generations. In effect, younger gay men don't get to see older gay men as healthy, sexy human beings or as role models for their own eventual aging. Because of this lack of interaction between the generations, we miss the opportunity for older men to pass along to the younger the lore and history of the gay community and the achievements and experiences of those who paved the way for the greater acceptance and rights that we now take for granted. Not all gay men feed into these myths, but they are prevalent. There are younger guys who are interested in older guys as friends and lovers and not just as sugar daddies, because the older guys seem to offer them better security and less drama than those their age. And there are older guys who sincerely like younger guys and who aren't looking for boy toys or trying to take advantage of their perceived naivety. And there are plenty of gay men who don't limit their friends to any particular age group. Some even find intergenerational friendships to be invaluable. Younger gay men can find the wisdom and life experiences of older gay men extremely helpful as they are experiencing life's ups and downs for the first time. Whether they are seeking advice on relationships, life changes, health, or other issues. And many older gay men revel in the chance to help and share their experiences with those younger. Unfortunately, there's a terrible age segregation in much of the gay men's community. Ageism is prevalent in large segments of the gay community, but ageist attitudes and actions are so common and accepted that sometimes it's a major issue just convincing people that there is a problem. Even among those who are vocal about fighting the other isms, such as racism and sexism, ageism and ageist attitudes aren't always recognized, let alone spoken out against. One place ageism is really prevalent is in gay personal ads. These can be especially brutal on the older crowd. Incidentally, I was perusing personals on a site called Adam for Adam just yesterday. One of those ads stated, "No one over 30, I don't want to date my dad." Other ads suggest, "No one over 25, please, and if you're not my age, you're not my type." In online chat rooms, one of the first things asked is age, as in ASL, age, sex, location. Many of us aren't LOL, laughing out loud. Many myths and negative stereotypes exist concerning the elderly and the homosexual. Together, the older gay male suffers from a double stigma in American society. The image of the older gay man as depressed, isolated, desperate, and sexless is prevalent. This image, however, does not hold up to most older gay men's experience, though there is a grain of truth to it. Older gay men do face challenges. They are more likely than straight men to struggle with isolation and invisibility, because as they get older, gay men are less likely to be partnered or to have children than straight men. And older gay men may be less sexually desirable than younger gay men, and their perception of undesirability may limit their available partners. Bergling, in his survey, also discovered that many older gay men will do anything to try to remain young, or at least young-looking. Everything from dressing young to dyeing their hair to cosmetic surgery. Another researcher named Andrew Hostetler, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota, asked gay men over the age of 35 about their attitudes toward aging. More than two-thirds thought there were opportunities to get involved in their local LGBT communities, but over half felt unappreciated by gay men under the age of 30. Almost half felt ignored because of their age. He also discovered that often gay men in their 30s will find partnership, at least partly out of a fear of growing old alone. Despite advancements in gay awareness and rights, the younger generations still have their own struggles too. While coming out has become easier for younger guys, many still face their own challenges of coming to terms, meeting others, and deciding whether or not to tell their family and friends. The internet has made this easier in many respects, but they still may experience opposition from family and friends and harassment from their peers. The middle-aged crowd may have it worst of all. Those who are too old to be twinks and too young to be sexy daddies often have to learn the hard way what it is to be an aging gay male, along with their normal midlife crisis. They may find they're not as welcome at the clubs and crowds they used to frequent as they realize their own fading youth and sexual desirability. Many gay men in this age group experience a desire to settle down out of a fear of growing old alone. I'll talk more about possible rites of passage in an upcoming episode of this show. I think gay men approaching middle age are in especial need of some kind of rite to ease their transition into this stage of life. As for intergenerational relationships, there are many challenges, but also many benefits to such arrangements. Partners in relationships where there is an age difference, especially a significant age difference, must deal with the myths, stereotypes, and ageist attitudes already mentioned. Their motives may be constantly questioned by outsiders, and they may have to weather some brutal comments from time to time, sometimes including those made by friends and family. In spite of this, most of those surveyed by Bergling are in favor of such relationships, provided true love is present and both partners are of legal age. Some psychologists are also supportive. Michael Chernoff, a New York psychotherapist, believes that an age difference of at least 15 years between partners can be beneficial. One of the major difficulties of male-male relationships is one of competitiveness. Such an age difference lessens the effect of competitiveness significantly. Another psychologist, Doug Favero from DC, agrees and suggests that the older partner can bring emotional stability and maturity into a relationship, and the younger can bring in energy and enthusiasm that can bring out the older man's inner youthfulness. There can be some downsides to these types of relationships, too. For instance, if they should take on a parent-child or similar dynamic that undermines the equality and balance of the relationship. Another concern would be if the older partner were acting out some kind of denial or neurosis surrounding sex, aging, or a delayed adolescence. There are also double standards in our culture related to age differences in relationships. Among heterosexual men, an older man with a hot, younger female is something to be looked up to and admired, though sometimes the motives of the younger woman are called into question if the guy is rich, and an older woman with a younger man still calls to question the motives of the older woman among many, though these types of relationships are becoming more accepted as well. Regardless of your take on age, aging, and age differences in relationships, there is one truth that few can deny. Older gay men have an obligation to leave a better world for the younger generations, and the younger generations need to make the world safe for the older generations.
What do you know about sexual relations?
I don't know. Nothing much. I'm a little worried about being a slut.
The druids get down with the flashing strobe. All the ladies wanna tear off that funky robe. The druids work out on their new Bowflex. Everyone's jinxed or cursed or vexed. Hey! Hip hip hooray for the Sunday day. Hip hip hooray for the relay race. Hip hip hooray for the Sunday day. Hip hip hooray for the relay race. Guitars at the pagan's pass. It's a druidy druid world. It's the guitars at the pagan's pass. Oh,
cha cha cha, cha cha cha.
All the cool kids want my hooded robe. Oh, run the relay race. Dragonfield is my four-course meal. I did a spell with a banana peel. Hey, hey, hey.
Hip hip hooray for the Sunday day. Hip hip hooray for the relay race. Hip hip hooray for the Sunday day. Hip hip hooray for the relay race. It's a druid, druid world. It's the baton at the pagan. It's a druidy druid world. It's the baton at the pagan's pass. Oh, oh,
take me home,
take me home,
take me home. You Anglo-Saxon whippersnapper. It's a modern day druid world. My Bowflex only makes me stronger. I've got a jar full of virgin bones. I've got a calendar made of stones.
Hey, 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 hey. Hip hip hooray for the Sunday day.
That was It's a Druid Eat Druid World by Alex Aerosmith. To purchase and download the entire song, you can go to www.emusic.com.
You're a little young for me, honey. Why don't you come back when you grow some hair on your nuts and we'll talk about it.
You're dealing with organs that people just don't want to know about.
I want to take a few minutes out of today's show to talk about my own experiences with age as related to being gay. While I can trace my own attraction to men back even further than the first stirrings of puberty, I didn't really come to terms with it and accept it until around the later half of my 11th grade year in high school. One of the things that helped me immensely to come to terms was finding out that my uncle is also gay. He lived a couple of states away, but I called him and talked to him on the phone on a few occasions about what it is to be gay. I think if I hadn't had someone to talk to about things, or if my uncle had refused to talk to me because I was under 18, it would have been a lot harder for me to accept myself, especially given that all the other things I heard about being gay from my church to my peers was terribly negative. At that time, I kind of had it in my mind that I'd fall in love and have a marriage of sorts with someone within a few years of my age. Of course, reality seems to have proven me wrong on both counts. My uncle and his partner aside, it wasn't until the second semester of my freshman year in college that I actually found and met with other gay people. I joined both the gay and lesbian student group at college, which was just starting at that time, and a local gay youth group. After the youth group meetings, we'd head down to a local bar that had a dinner buffet, and we'd play pool for a while after dinner. The bar didn't enforce its no one under 21 rule until later in the evening. One of the first guys who ever hit on me was another member of the youth group named Joe. I was 18 at the time, and I'm guessing he was around 22 or 23. He couldn't have been much older than that since the youth group had an upper age limit. He was very bold and touchy-feely. I remember him holding me in his arms while we watched other group members playing pool. I wasn't really attracted to him, but I had little practice in these types of situations, and I was kind of shy at the time, so I wasn't very assertive either. It was kind of nice to have the attention and affection, but as he held me, I was looking across the pool table at another guy named Jim, who was to become my first real boyfriend. I don't even remember much about what happened. I really think that the one night in the bar was it, but I do remember I held some amount of animosity toward Joe after that. I don't really think it had anything to do with age, just that I wasn't really attracted to him and it felt like I was being taken advantage of somehow. Shortly after that, I started dating Jim, who was 5 years older than I am. It lasted just short of a year. I think part of the reason was that I had a much more idealized view of relationships, and being a few years older than me, he'd had time to become cynical about them. I loved him a great deal, and I can't say I ever truly got over him, though I did move on with life and eventually became more cynical about love myself. After Jim, I went out with a guy who was 12 years older than me. We'd known each other for a while through the college group, and there was mutual attraction. We went out a couple of times and even got naked once, though we didn't get as far as actually having sex of any kind. The age difference really bothered him, so he called things off. But after I got over the rejection, a few months later we began hanging out together again, and we became very good friends. Our friendship lasted for a few years, until he moved out of the area. We even wrote back and forth for a while, but eventually lost touch. I often wonder where he is and what he's doing. In between, I had several flings, a few one-night stands, and lots of unrequited love. My second real boyfriend, Steve, approached me at a gay dance that I helped put together as part of our local Winter Pride Festival. I was 22. He turned out to be 8 years older than me, and I think he had a thing for younger guys, which was okay with me because by that time I had a thing for guys who were a bit older and more mature than me. I considered them more stable and secure than most guys my age who seemed only to want a party. The thing I liked about Steve was that he was such a gentleman and he was so affectionate, which was a stark contrast to my first boyfriend, Jim. He also took me places and always insisted on buying me dinner when we went out. I felt a great deal of safety and security in his arms. We dated for 8 or 9 months. Really, in my 20s, I didn't think much about age, at least in the sense that I see among some young gay men when it comes to segregating themselves into groups of only those in their age group. I was actively involved in my college gay and lesbian student group and actively networked with older gay, lesbian, and straight but supportive faculty and staff members. Many became good friends, including a middle-aged gay male faculty member. I was the college group's liaison to our local pride committee that put together winter and summer pride festivals. Most of the other members of the group were well into their 30s and beyond. I never thought twice about it. When I hit age 30, a strange thing happened. I started realizing what ageism existed toward the over 30 crowd. Actually, I think my first taste of this was when I was 29, and I asked a friend to set me up with this guy in his lower to mid 20s, and the guy said he wasn't interested. I was too old. About the same time, I got a staff job at the same college where I had been a member of the gay student group. I'd kept in contact with the student group even as alumni, and when I returned to college, it seemed only fitting that I should support the group wherever and whenever I could. For the first year or so, everything went fairly well, and the students were generally appreciative of my efforts. I was even a bit of a legend, since many of the advances that had been achieved at the college with regard to GLBT rights had been the result of the efforts of myself and a few others during my college years. When I hit 30, I noticed that after some of the events where people would go out for dinner or coffee, I was no longer being invited. I mentioned this to someone, but he said he didn't think ageism was coming into play. Later that year, I developed a crush on this other guy in the group. I mean, I just turned 30 and he was in his 20s, so while there was some difference in our ages, it wasn't really that big of a gap. One of the other guys in the group was a graduate student who was dating a faculty member at least 20 years his senior, though I'd guess even more than that. I thought he'd be supportive, so I confided in him about my crush. But I got the impression that in his eyes I might as well have been a pedophile trying to seduce a child. I mean, I had a crush and I was going to this other guy for assistance and advice. This guy was the last person I'd expect to cash into the myth that older men are out to seduce younger. Ironically, his partner also voiced similar sentiments when the GLBT faculty and staff group talked about forming a mentoring program. He was opposed to it because he saw potential problems with older faculty and staff being out to seduce younger students. On a side note, I saw this older staff member frequenting the sauna in the men's locker room often when I was changing to go to the gym. You do the math. As a result of my admitting a simple and I thought innocent crush on someone, I noticed after that I became less and less welcome at events of the very student group that I'd done so much for over the course of nearly a decade. And whenever I did attend something or make an effort to assert my rights that I'd fought for so long to advance, that I only got backlash. Somehow I'd become the de facto enemy of the group I'd invested so much of my ideals and energy into. I mean, if the guy I had a crush on wasn't interested, he could have just told me and I would have moved on. But he never did. At first I couldn't tell whether the prejudice came from him or those who surrounded him, so admittedly I probably didn't back down from trying to get to know him better as soon as I should have. Whenever I did see him, I'd get mixed signals anyway. It was a very bad experience for me. It was a few years before I'd even set foot again in a gay bar, and to this day I'm reluctant to show up at any kind of organized gay event, let alone invest my energy in any kind of organized gay group. Perhaps someday the wounds will heal, and I will, but for the present I'm somewhat wary. As for friends, I have many friends of all ages, both gay and straight, men and women, of all sizes and shapes. I try not to look at age when choosing my friends. When it comes to dating, I freely admit that I've done a total flip. When I was in my 20s, I looked for and found myself attracted to guys older than me, even into their 30s. Now that I'm in my 30s, I find myself looking at and attracted to guys in their 20s, though I wouldn't turn down someone older by me by about a decade, provided I liked him and I was attracted to him. For me, though, I think somehow an age difference is important. Even if it's 5 years one direction or another, I don't really want to date a clone of myself, but would rather find someone complimentary. I was recently talking to my friend David, who's in his 40s. Yeah, I know he's an old geezer. Just kidding, Dave. About my tastes in men, and often the men I point out to him have a complimentary characteristic to something of my own. I usually point out dark-haired guys as opposed to my ash blonde, or shorter guys. I also like taller guys. So anyway, I would date a guy a decade or so younger than myself, but he'd have to be stable, mature, and able to support himself financially. But to be fair, I'd expect the same thing from someone older than myself. I'd date a guy a decade or so older than myself, but he'd have to take care of himself and be somewhat health conscious. He couldn't be too set in his ways or unable to have fun, and I'd have to be attracted to him. But I'd apply those very same standards to someone younger than myself.
Here are the facts as I see them.
Very fact.
I save the most controversial topic of the show for last. Often, I like to offer alternative models for gay relationships and gay spirituality that sometimes run counter to what we accept as, quote, normal, acceptable, or desired. I'm not advocating that adult listeners go out and start dating someone underage, as this is in fact illegal. Or put another way, you've probably heard the expression jailbait. What I do hope is that you'll listen with an open mind, perhaps even suspending Western Christian influenced attitudes to see whether these systems had value in their respective cultures and whether we can learn anything that we can apply to our own culture today. Pederasty is the intimate or erotic relationship between an adult male and an adolescent male. This is not to be confused with pedophilia, which is a sexual relationship between an adult and a pre-adolescent child. Pederasty has been practiced in some form in most cultures throughout history, often as a stage of growth or rite of passage of young men into adulthood. It has been practiced by the Greeks, the Romans, the Celts, the Persians, the Mayans, in China and Japan among the samurai and within certain sects of Buddhism, Korea, and Melanesia. In the Islamic world, spiritual pederasty was incorporated into many mystic Sufi teachings. In fact, our Western Christian-influenced society is an exception to the cultural and historical norm. That said, I'd like to point out again that relations between an adult and an adolescent below the age of consent is not only looked down upon in our society, but is also illegal. While the historical record shows that pederasty has been the predominant expression of male-male sexuality, the practice of pederasty varied widely among different cultures. Pederasty has been associated with coming-of-age rituals, with the acquisition of virility and manly virtue, with educational aspiration, and even with military skill and camaraderie. In some cultures, pederasty was used as a means of population control. In many societies, pederastic relationships were identified with the upper classes or involved a class difference between the partners. At times, this was seen as helping the younger partner to be upwardly mobile. At other times, this was seen as the symbol of the power of love to transcend class distinctions. The Greeks. The ancient Greeks were the first to institutionalize pederasty as part of their city-states and to study its benefits. Though the practice may have been formalized as early as the late Minoan civilization around 1650 BC, the key value of Greek pederasty was fostering excellence in the youth as well as the man who loved him. To the Greeks, pederasty was a relationship and a bond between an adolescent boy and an adult man outside his immediate family. The relationship may or may not have been sexual. While most Greek men engaged in relations with both women and boys, there were exceptions to this rule. Pederastic relationships were mentorships that were sanctioned by the state and consecrated by the Greek religious establishment. Boys entered these relationships in their teens, and the relationship had to be approved by the boy's father. These relationships were widely practiced as an educational device. The mentor was expected to teach the youth, to provide for his education, and to give him certain ceremonial gifts. Often these relationships coexisted within a military context. These relationships were seen to involve the highest civil and moral values and ideals. The state was said to benefit, and it kept the youth out of trouble. Often it was the elder who was punished if the youth committed a crime. In the military, the two fought side by side, each trying to impress the other. These couples were also feared by tyrants because their bond was stronger than their obedience to a tyrannical ruler. Rome. In Rome, pederasty largely lost its status as a ritualized form of education and was seen more as an activity primarily driven by sexual desires and competing with a desire for women. It was more formal and often involved men taking advantage of their social status to exact sexual favors from their social inferiors. There were also illicit relationships with freeborn boys. The acceptance of pederastic relationships in Rome waxed and waned over the centuries. Many Roman emperors indulged in pederastic relations, and of the first 15 Roman emperors, Claudius was the only one who didn't engage in this practice. One Roman emperor, Lucius Cornelius Sulla, acknowledged Metrobius, a Roman tragic actor of Greek birth, as his lover in his final speech to the Roman Senate, much to the dismay of the audience. Pederasty reached its peak during the time of the Emperor Hadrian, who fell in love with Antonius, a young teenage Greek. Upon the youth's premature death, Hadrian deified Antonius, declaring him a god. The Celts. The Celts were another culture that practiced pederasty. Athenius in the Dionysophis states that the Celts also partook, and despite the beauty of their women, preferred the love of boys. Some would regularly bed down on their animal skins with a lover on each side. It has been a topic of debate whether he meant that the Celts had a boy on each side or whether he meant they had a boy on one side and a woman on the other. Other writers such as Aristotle, Strabo, and Diodorus Siculus also attested to Celtic pederasty. China. In 10th century China, male couples consisted of an elder, quote, brother, and a younger brother. It is very common in Chinese culture to identify alliances as fictional family relationships. Boy marriages lasted for a set period, at which time the younger partner would find a wife. The boy marriages were said to have been celebrated by both families in the traditional fashion, including the ritual 9 cups of tea. In Fujian, these relationships even had a patron god named Hu Tianbao. Men's sexual interest in youth was also reflected in prostitution. Young male sex workers often get higher prices than their female counterparts. In Tianjin, there were 35 male brothels housing 800 boys, and the men of the area were assumed to be experts in anal relations. Japan. In Japan, the practice of Shudo, the way of the young, was prevalent in the religious community and samurai society from the medieval period onward. Eventually, it even grew to permeate all of society. It fell out of favor around the end of the 19th century at a time of growing European influence. Kukai, the founder of the Shing'an school of Buddhism, is said to have brought the teachings of male love over from China along with the teachings of the Buddha. Monks often entered into love relationships with beautiful youths known as chigo. Early European visitors were surprised, even dismayed, at the openness of such relationships and how it was seen as natural, even virtuous. In some cases, the love between men of higher classes and boys of lower classes was held up as a symbol of the power of love to transcend class distinctions. Melanesia. In Melanesia, many of the native cultures employed boy insemination rites as integral parts of their coming-of-age rituals, lasting from mid to late childhood. Some of the native tribes consider sperm to be the essence of masculinity and a source of strength. They believe this substance doesn't form on its own in a youth, but that it must be introduced. I'm visualizing a turkey baster here, but that's just me. As part of this rite, a mentor chosen by the father, and often the boy's uncle, has the duty of planting his sperm in the body of the pre-adolescent. The mentor also has the duty of educating the boy and seeing to his proper entry into manhood. They sleep and work together until the boy is mature. Casual encounters between boys and men are also accepted, though the boy must be the recipient, the bottom as it were, to avoid damaging his growth. North America. Of the Koniagas of Kodiak Island and the Thinkleets, we read the most repugnant of all their practices is that of male concubinage. A Kodiak mother will select her handsomest and most promising boy and dress and rear him as a girl, teaching him only domestic duties, keeping him at women's work, associating him with women and girls in order to render his effeminacy complete. Arriving at the age of 10 or 15 years, he is married to some wealthy man who regards such a companion as a great acquisition. In California, the first missionaries found the same practice, the youths being called joya. Central America. In Central America, the peoples regularly practice pederastic relationships. Male adolescent sacred prostitutes would congregate in temples. The conquistadors who arrived in Central America in the 16th century were horrified by the widespread practice and acceptance of sex between men and youths in Aztec society. This, in fact, was one of their justifications for their extermination of the Aztec society, religion, and culture, and claiming the lands and wealth. The only practice they abhorred more was the practice of human sacrifice among the Aztecs. As for Mayan culture, the early Mayans were thought to be strongly against same-sex relationships, but later Mayan states accepted and employed pederastic practices. These practices were ascribed to the god Chen, of whom very little else is known. As part of this practice, the father would find a younger lover for his son. These were seen as legal marriages, and any attempt on the honor of the younger partner by another was considered adultery. The conquistador Bernal Diaz reported finding statues of male couples making love in temples at Cape Catoche, Yucatan. While pederasty was associated with virtue and high ideals in many of these cultures, there was still debate over its practice in many of these cultures. Often it was the sexual aspects that were considered unfavorable, as opposed to the more spiritual, non-sexual expression. Among the Greeks, there were few cities that prohibited it. while others only permitted the non-sexual form. Plato's writings condemned sexual intercourse with the boys one loved, but glorified the self-disciplined lover who abstained from sex with his beloved. Christianity and other related religions have been quick to target pederasty in their conquests of other cultures and religions. The 2nd century preacher Clement of Alexandria claimed the pederasty among Greek gods and mythology in his indictment of Greek religion. He stated, "For your gods did not abstain even from boys. One loved Hylas, another Hyacinthus, another Pelops, another Chrysippus, another Ganymedes. These are the gods your wives worship." Modern constructs. In modern Western society, the gay movement early on distanced itself from the very notion of pederasty, probably in large part to the homophobic mythology that older gay men seduce and convert younger gay men into, quote, the homosexual lifestyle. Instead of using Greek pederasty as a model for gay relationships, the movement has focused on those rarer Hellenic instances where homosexual relationships were more egalitarian, such as between Alexander the Great and his friend Hephaestion. Some have argued that such attitudes are counterproductive and will only lead to the ghettoization of homosexuality. Not everyone has accepted the current model of gay relationships as mimicking straight marriage between persons of equal age and status. Not that straight relationships live up to these ideals either. No talk about pederasty in modern times would be complete without talking about NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association. I don't really know a lot about their views, but one of their platforms is seeking to abolish the age of consent laws that they say, quote, unfairly criminalizes sexual relationships between men and minors, particularly boys. I'm unclear whether by boys they mean teens or preteens, which could put the discussion from pederasty to pedophilia. Whatever your take on this matter, you do have to give them one thing. At least they're honest and upfront about their proclivities, unlike the many Catholic priests a few years ago who scandalized the Catholic Church with their own relations with underage boys. Another fairly recent scandal included Republican House of Representatives delegate Mark Foley, who exchanged pederastic communications with a large number of teenage pages over the course of several years. Some countries have done away with or lowered the age of consent without significant increases of the number of relationships between older men and teens. Sexual relationships between adults and adolescents has not been widely studied and has often been lumped together with pedophilia, probably because of issues of, quote, morality and legality where the minor is below the age of consent. One study countering this position, authored by the American academic Bruce Rind and others, was published by the American Psychological Association in 1998. The history and scope of pederasty has been the subject of extensive censorship. In the West, the topic was suppressed in academic circles for much of modern history. The unspoken ban was broken only in 1905 by the German historian Erich Beff with his study, Dorian Boy Love, Its Ethic, Its Idea. In the USA, as late as 2005, Haworth Press withdrew from publication a volume on homosexuality in classical antiquity titled Same-Sex Desire and Love in Greco-Roman Antiquity and in the Classical Tradition of the West. This was in response to criticism from American right-wing groups that objected to the book's depiction of classical pederasty, as well as to the substance of a chapter by the American academic Bruce Rind, which integrated observations from history, anthropology, and zoology, and which was interpreted by some readers as advocating pedophilia. The publisher, in a letter to the editors, attempted to exonerate Rind from the accusation and conceded that the article was sound, but stood by his decision to withdraw it to avoid negative press and economic repercussions. Despite its suppression in modern Western society and the belief that such relationships are harmful to the youth, homosexual pederasty has been deemed beneficial by groups such as ancient philosophers, Japanese samurai, and modern writers such as Oscar Wilde. In many societies, it was justified on the grounds that the boy needed sexual relations with a man in order to become a man himself, and that man-boy relations were superior to relations with a woman. Regardless of your take on the topic, there is one thing I'd like for you to think about before ending. Richard Goldstein, executive editor of the Village Voice, wrote in the August 20, 2002 issue of The Advocate, pointing out a double standard in our society and the presence of a new gay morality police, a new kind of witch hunt in our society. While rightly refusing to minimize the long-lasting effects of actual child abuse, Goldstein talks about how our society has turned a natural attraction for fit and handsome male adolescents into a pathology, even coining the term ephebophilia to describe it. He states that the ancient Athenians certainly didn't regard an attraction to such lads as a disease, but we do. He says that just having an attraction to a teen can make you an ephebophile, according to some therapists. He also sees a double standard in our society, citing numerous cases of heterosexual men, some of them celebrities, caught with underage girls and only given a slap on the wrist about it, and no one considers that a disease. According to Goldstein, our society condemns men who have sex with teenage boys while savoring the fantasy of men who have sex with girls of the same age. He questions the underlying message that homosexuality is more dangerous and more diseased than heterosexuality. If any gay man who finds teenage males sexy is arbitrarily branded an ephebophile, that's when a newly minted mental illness becomes an instrument of oppression.
Lots of young people hitchhike. Seems like a good way to get from one place to another. But sometimes there are dangers involved that never meet the eye. So no matter where you meet a stranger, be careful if they are too friendly. One never knows when the homosexual is about. Let's take the case of Jimmy Barnes. Jimmy played baseball all afternoon, and he didn't feel like walking home, so he decided to thumb a ride. He'd done it 100 times before, and he didn't think anything was unusual when the driver struck up a friendly conversation. In fact, he seemed like a real nice guy. What Jimmy didn't know was that Ralph was sick, a sickness that was not visible like smallpox, but no less dangerous and contagious, a sickness of the mind. You see, Ralph was a homosexual, a person who demands an intimate relationship with members of their own sex. So no matter where you meet a stranger, be careful if they are too friendly, if they try to win your confidence too quickly, and if they become overly personal. One never knows when the homosexual is about. He may appear normal.
Thanks for listening to Discovering the Male Mysteries with Mel Mystery Podcast. You can find out more information about the show, its hosts, and find a link to our Yahoo group by going to http://melmystery.matrixwerx.com. That's http://melmystery.matrixwerx.com. If you would like to submit original poetry or music, suggest a topic, or guest host a future segment, you can find information on how to do so, including a way to email me, on the Male Mysteries website. This is what you call an Easter egg. This year, Easter and St. Patrick's Day fall during the same week. This song's a little bit crude for me, but you might like it. If you do, look it up on emusic.com under the name of Sesame Street Gangsters.
In the times when many gods ruled over man in the hills of Ireland, lay a small village nestled in the midst of High Sheep Mountain, in a place where magical creatures once lived and flourished, a time of man, myth, and legend. Came a story passed down from generation to generation, father to son, all world to know. A story of two creatures who were sought out by every man in the land. For if they caught one, whatever their heart desired would come true. It was these songs that many men have heard, but you live to tell. This is the story of the gay leprechaun. Bad dreaming.